Quote number six is from social historian Elizabeth Roberts. And she says, social historians studying the working class in the recent past are almost overwhelmed at times by the total devotion and dedication shown towards the concept of respectability. Even in the midst of the bloody First World War, the preoccupation with respectability was extremely strong. I've got some quotes there from Lena Ashwell, who was a famous actress who toured France with concert parties to entertain and to elevate the troops. And you have a couple of quotes from her mailbag. First of all, an officer thanking her because the whole tone of your entertainment, the class of music, and the entire absence of vulgarity are a liberal education to the men. After 40 years' service in the army, I feel convinced that is what is sadly wanted for our men and sometimes for others. Everything should be done to elevate them and alter their tastes. So in a situation where a quarter of them will not come back, and nevertheless there's a very, very strong emphasis on this importance of this concept of elevation and respectability. I'm going to jump a little bit so I keep with my timing. For the dominated classes, and in particular working class, respectability was contradictory and ambiguous. Respectability includes elements of respecting yourself. No excessive indulgence in alcohol. No excessive violence in the family or in public. Cleanliness, hygiene, all of these things are part of respectability. And these are elements which are generally in the interests of the individuals and perhaps also of the working class in general. This is no doubt why temperance campaigns had strong roots in the working class and not just in elite groups. There are a whole series of working class leaders from Chartism through to the New Unionism, through to the beginnings of the Labour Party, strong advocates of temporism or even of teetotalism, and it's something which, in a situation also, it must be remembered, what they really knew how to drink. You know, I mean, finding people unconscious through drink was an everyday occurrence, and so they didn't see things in the same way as drunkards do today. But respectability also included, for the working class, very strong elements of respecting the existing social and gender hierarchies. Just to give an example or two from the field I'm most familiar with, the world of entertainment, I could cite the case of the orchestra in Cheltenham. The musicians earned only £1.05 a week, less than a skilled manual worker, and only just enough for a family to eat. However, to ensure respectability, they were banned from wearing caps on the way to and from work, since caps would symbolise that they belonged to the working class and were therefore assumed to be suspect in their respectability. In Birmingham, at the variety theatres, the flute player earned £1.16 a week for all the evening dress which he wore. This latter example is part of a long tradition of obliging working class people to disguise themselves as members of the elite, if they want to participate in high culture. And this can still happen today. So, respectability has these two sides to it. One, absolutely, really quite important elements for self-development and self-defense, and also elements which are really about respecting your betters. And thirdly, there's a whole series of ambiguous or intermediate elements, such as improving activities, high culture, reading, and the whole idea within which only leisure which corresponds to elite tastes is of any value. Indeed, throughout the second half of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, there is a massive campaign to ensure that the newly found leisure of the industrial workers is used in an improving manner. This is the period of the massive rise of local museums, parks and libraries, public toilets, brass bands, bandstands, choral societies, penny classical concerts. This is when you see the building of St George's Hall in Liverpool is 30 years earlier, but in Leeds, in Glasgow, the big concert halls, penny classical concerts for the poor to elevate them. All of these elements, which I've just mentioned, constitute both an improvement in working class lives, as a result, perhaps, partly, of the fear of working-class revolt after Chartism, but also an attempt by the elites to make sure that the newly found leisure was used in ways which could not become threatening. I'm going to move on to the campaign for respectability in the musical. Simons and Moore treated the Victorian music halls as symbolic of their revolt against middle-class respectability. The music hall is a protest against the villa, the circulating library, the club. This is the early halls of the 1850s. This is no longer the case 50 years later. There is a successful move in music hall towards becoming a respectable form of leisure. It is not definitively won. There are still sections of the elites who consider it's not respectable, but it's gone certainly a very long way. By the beginning of the 20th century, the music hall is the central component of mass entertainment. In 1907, over a million tickets are sold in London every week. So let's have a look then at respectability and how different groups deal with it in the context of the music hall. And I'm going to start with the question of the theatre managers. Very powerful people, but also people who were very worried about the competition, in a very tense situation. Certainly from the 1880s on, the musical proprietors, anxious to attract better-paying customers and afraid of the activities of moralist organisations which sometimes succeeded in stopping them from renewing musical licences, they threw themselves heart and soul into the cleaning up of music hall. They also chased respectability obsessively. Quote 9 as is from a study of music hall in Scotland, and the historian points out, it seems likely that managers were attempting to install middle-class values or notions of respectability in the music hall so that upwardly mobile sections of the lower classes would feel that they could attend music hall without compromising their social aspirations. But the music hall proprietors, once the process of centralisation was underway, which was leading to the rise of big theatre chains, also had personal projects to join the local elites. In 1870, if you're the manager of a big music hall, you are not part of the local elites. In 1910, you can be. What could they do then? What could these music hall managers do to ensure and to police respectability in the halls? The first thing they could do is to change the architecture. In the new big variety halls that are built in the 1900s, there are separate entrances. If you go into, you can't move from one part of the theatre to the other. The working class go in this entrance and up there, and the middle class go in this entrance and down there, or the other way around. So actually a physical separation, because the big fear of the elite was that middle class women and working class men would be found in the same place. The second thing they did, again on the lines of architecture, is closing down the promenades. So the promenade is a sort of area behind the music hall where you walk around and smoke. And they were allegedly places which prostitutes used to pick up clients. It's very difficult to know how much of this was in the heads of the moral reformers. Certainly, I mean, there certainly were sometimes used. And there were vocal campaigns in the 1890s, led by Mrs. Ormiston Chant, to close the promenades, and these campaigns continued for a long time. As late as 1916, in the Empire Music Hall in London, the promenade was closed down for reasons of respectability. Along the similar lines, drinking alcohol was vastly curbed. Almost everywhere, there was no drinking in the auditorium after the 1900s. In a large number of halls, there was no drinking at all. This is not just the temperance halls who did it deliberately, especially in Scotland, for ideological reasons. This was just... Well, it was largely because it was difficult to get a licence, and so they had halls where they didn't sell music, although the pub across the road did good business during the interval. What else could the music hall managers do? They moved their music halls to more respectable parts of towns when they could. And also, from the 1890s on, the music halls tried to cater for the more sophisticated tastes of their audience at the same time as trumpeting their respectability by including in their night's entertainment more and more elements of high culture. Extracts from Shakespeare, from Wagner's operas or Verdi's operas and so on would be integrated into the evening shows. Short plays were also included, and some of the most respected playwrights of the time, such as George Bernard Shaw or J.M. Barrie, after some hesitation, wrote for the music halls short works of around half an hour long. They also tried to control what comics and singers said on stage. As you can see in quote number 10, the standard contract in use in 1907 included the following clause. Any artist giving any expression to any vulgarity or words having a double meaning will be instantly dismissed. And this was not unusual. Let's move on to the press of the industry. The trade press, the main music hall trade magazine, is the Encore. And the Era is a trade paper mostly about legitimate theatre, as they say, but also wrote about music hall. And even during the First World War, editorials in the Encore seemed to talk more frequently about respectability than about the war, which is quite surprising when you look at it. According to the editorial of the Era in May 1915, quote 11, the ruder performers poison the wine of life with the lees of lasciviousness. I had to look up the word lees, it means dregs. Okay, it's very French, actually, in a way, isn't it? They continue, we heard something very rude recently, and we were surprised they didn't just ring the curtain down. The new rising format in the musicals, the review, came in for particular criticism, the same editorial. Many of the reviews have some kind of seaside scene. You don't look shocked. Okay, and some of the producers have a clearly pornographic intent. Unfortunately, the editor goes on to say, if we print specific and outspoken criticism of indecency, the house is packed with people the following week. So we can see that there is a certain popular resistance to this respectability discourse, although this popular resistance is very rarely expressed. There's nobody who stands up and saying respectability is a load of rubbish. Almost nobody is prepared to say that. And so you get people who say, well, respectability is very important, but I'm part of respectability. I'm accused of being vulgar, but I'm not. Somebody else is vulgar. We can see more examples in quotes 12 and quote 13, but I'm going to move on a little more quickly than that. The government and other moral authorities are also very much involved. The Church of England, just a few months before it showed its unconditional and enthusiastic support for the British Empire's war aims, was involved in that a group of bishops were organised in an attempt to make the music halls more respectable. According to the Times in February 1914, quote 14, it was not that they were opposing the amusements of the theatre or the music hall, expecting them to produce sermons night after night, but that those who did go should find nothing there to make their girls blush or anything to stain the imagination of their boys. Magistrates were also very active. This is not just a matter of powerless complaining. A large number of licences were refused after lobbying by the local clergy and by the local moral organisations. The government weighed in May 1915. The Lord Chamberlain, who's the head of censorship, sent out a general warning against suggestiveness, impropriety of language, and scantiness of dress. You would even get quite solid support from a rather surprising quarter, and that is the socialist press. The Clarion, which is no doubt the most successful socialist weekly of the time in 1907, they claimed sales of 74,000 every week. They claimed that the grand and exciting new variety theatres would draw workers away from coarser and more drunken pursuits, quote 15. The Palace, the theatre, may have been a capitalist venture, but it was one that treated workers as respectable consumers capable of differentiating wholesome from disreputable pastimes. And finally, let's move on to the artists themselves. Well, one of the attractions of the musical had always been its class content, mocking the authority of the policeman and the rent collector, and puncturing the pretensions of the snob, had a permanent popularity in working class entertainment. And vulgarity was part of this content, although no doubt not as widespread as had been feared by the overactive imaginations of the moral crusaders. But in general, transgression has always been a part of popular culture and popular music, from carnival to gangster rap. And in music hall, transgression is part of the entertainment, part of the sweet Saturday night, as Colin McInnes has termed it. But as music hall became a mass entertainment, the transgression had to be more carefully measured. We do have some evidence that in the 1840s and the 1850s, there were quite a large number of music hall songs which were openly bawdy, or as you say in French, paillard. And j'avais demandé à ma femme une définition du mot paillard, et elle a dit c'est là où on met le mot à la chose. Alors j'ai bien compris la chose. This is no longer possible in the early 20th century. What you are talking about is a number of stars specialising in the suggestive. Songs like, she'd never had her ticket punched before. Yeah? Well, it was a very interesting case because it was very much criticised, and the editorial of the Encore wrote a long editorial explaining how people who thought that it was not about tickets just have dirty minds. So there you go. Now you know. The most famous of those who specialised in moderate transgression, Mary Lloyd, Whit Cunliffe and Harry Champion. Far and away the most successful, Mary Lloyd. In 1897, a representative of the Social Purity branch of the British Women's Temperance Association complained about a song sung by Mary Lloyd which suggested that the father of the narrator frequented prostitutes. She retaliated by singing a song which is, quote, 16, I mustn't tell you what I mean, mustn't tell you what I've seen, everything that's risky must be dropped. While I've been stopped from winking, mustn't tell you what I've heard, mustn't say a naughty word, so help my Bob, it's a jolly good job, they can't stop a girl from thinking. And Mary Lloyd will defend, to some extent, her suggestiveness. I'll bet if I sang the songs of Solomon set to music, I would be accused of making them bad. You don't suppose they want Sunday school stuff, do you? And quote 17. They don't pay their sixpences and shillings at a music hall to hear the Salvation Army. If I were to try to sing highly moral songs, they would fire ginger beer bottles and beer mugs at me. I can't help it if people want to turn and twist my meaning. She's exaggerating when she says people will throw bottles. That's a practice which was very common in the 1880s, which has almost disappeared by 1910. She was also refused entry to the United States for moral turpitude. On tour in Canada, one of her songs was banned. It was entitled The Ankle Watch. It's not a watch that you wear. The wristwatch was a new thing at this time. And so The Ankle Watch, because she was planning to show her, well, you know, ankles. The second singer I'm going to mention very briefly, Harry Champion, who sang Never Let Your Braces Dangle. And he also sang a song called The End of My Old Cigar. And I have a little quote from it here. One evening after supper, while strolling in the park, I came upon a lady. It was getting rather dark. Says she, can you direct me? I've wandered rather far. So I takes a puff and shows her the way with the end of my old cigar. Okay. So that sounds like something going on in New York. Okay. You can see on your handout a list of songs which might be considered to be playing with the limits of respectability. Some of them discuss the question openly. I love the song whose title is It May Be All Right, But It's the Look of the Thing. It's a very, very discursive song. I wanted to give you quite a long list because I wanted to show you that it's a lot of songs. It's not just one or two. I don't have time to say anymore. I have to come right to my conclusion. What are the similarities and differences between the campaign for respectability and the campaign against antisocial behaviour? I ought to warn you, I only have half the answer. I'm kind of hoping you might have more. They both come under the heading of moral regulation. They are both ways used by the elites to try to control the behaviour of individuals belonging to subordinate classes. They're both based on individualist philosophy in the sense that they concentrate on individual behaviour, and the contrast between the importance given to codes of individual behaviour in a context of massive social injustice is particularly visible during the First World War. Both campaigns try very hard to recruit the dominated classes into the same worldview by setting up a denigrated other, a type of person to be rejected, the hoodie, or the vulgar person. And they both involve a central concept, respectability, and antisocial behaviour, which is not clearly delineated, but which is open to a certain amount of definition, negotiation, and redefinition. But there are, of course, very, very important differences. First of all, antisocial behaviour as an ideology is quite recent. If you look through all the Labour Party manifestos since 1900, thank God for the internet, the 1997 one and the 2001 are the only ones which mention antisocial behaviour or something similar. And the Conservatives mention it in 2001 and 1997 only. The Liberal Democrats use it a little bit more. They begin in 1992. But this is a very, very new idea. So that's one difference. Another difference, the agents are different. The campaign against antisocial behaviour came more from a political elite, whereas the campaign for respectability came more from a social elite. And finally, of course, only one of the two was really a popular obsession. Respectability has a historical force and a social power, which is incommensurably bigger than the campaign against antisocial behaviour. That's all for today. Thank you.
Good DJ act into Emma's talk now about antisocial behaviour.
Yes.